The gold nuggets of Cap'n Crunch pelt the bottom of the bowl with a sound like glass rods being snapped in half. Tiny fragments spall away from their corners and ricochet around on the white porcelain surface. World-class cereal eating is a dance of fine compromises. The giant heaping bowl of sodden cereal awash in milk is the mark of the novice. Ideally, one wants the bone-dry cereal nuggets and the cryogenic milk to enter the mouth with minimal contact and for the entire reaction between them to take place in the mouth. Randy has worked out a set of mental blueprints for a special cereal-eating spoon that will have a tube running down the handle and a little pump for the milk, so that you can spoon dry cereal up out of a bowl, hit a button with your thumb, and squirt milk into the bowl of the spoon even as you are introducing it into your mouth. The next best thing is to work in small increments, putting only a small amount of Cap'n Crunch in your bowl at a time and eating it all up before it becomes a pit of loathsome slime, which, in the case of Cap'n Crunch, takes about 30 seconds. At this point in the videotape, he always wonders if he's inadvertently set his beard down on the fast-forward button, or something, because the dancers go straight from their vicious Randy parody into something that obviously qualifies as advanced dancing. Randy knows that the steps they are doing are nominally the same as the basic steps demonstrated earlier, but he's damned if he can tell which is which once they go into their creative mode. There is no recognizable transition. And that is what pisses Randy off, and has always pissed him off, about dancing lessons. Any moron can learn to trudge through the basic steps. That takes all of half an hour. But when that half hour is over, dancing instructors always expect you'll take flight and go through one of those miraculous time-lapse transitions that happen only in Broadway musicals, and begin dancing brilliantly. Randy supposes that people who are lousy at math feel the same way. The instructor writes a few simple equations on the board, and 10 minutes later he's deriving the speed of light in a vacuum. He pours the milk with one hand while jamming the spoon in with the other, not wanting to waste a single moment of the magical golden time when cold milk and Cap'n Crunch are together, but have not yet begun to pollute each other's essential natures. Two platonic ideals, separated by a boundary a molecule wide. Where the flume of milk splashes over the spoon handle, the polished stainless steel fogs with condensation. Randy, of course, uses whole milk, because otherwise, why bother? Anything less is indistinguishable from water, and besides, he thinks that the fat in whole milk acts as some kind of a buffer that retards the dissolution into slime process. The giant spoon goes into his mouth before the milk in the bowl has even had time to seek its own level. A few drips come off the bottom and are caught by his freshly washed goatee. Still trying to find the right balance between beardedness and vulnerability, Randy has allowed one of these to grow. Randy sets the milk pod down, grabs a fluffy napkin, lifts it to his chin, and uses a pinching motion to sort of lift the drops of milk from his whiskers, rather than smashing and smearing them down into the beard. Meanwhile, all his concentration is fixed on the interior of his mouth, which naturally he cannot see, but which he can imagine in three dimensions, as if zooming through it in a virtual reality display. Here is where a novice would lose his cool and simply chomp down. A few of the nuggets would explode between his molars, but then his jaw would snap shut and drive all of the unshattered nuggets straight up into his palate, where their armor of razor-sharp dextrose crystals would inflict massive collateral damage, turning the rest of the meal into a sort of pain-hazed death march and rendering him Novocaine mute for 3 days. But Randy has, over time, worked out a really fiendish Cap'n Crunch eating strategy that revolves around playing the nuggets' most deadly features against each other. The nuggets themselves are pillow-shaped and vaguely striated to echo piratical treasure chests. Now, with a flake type of cereal, Randy's strategy would never work. But then Cap'n Crunch in a flake form would be suicidal madness. It would last about as long when immersed in milk as snowflakes sifting down into a deep fryer. No, the cereal engineers at General Mills had to find a shape that would minimize surface area, and as some sort of compromise between the sphere that is dictated by Euclidean geometry and whatever sunken treasure-related shapes that the cereal aestheticians were probably clamoring for, they came up with this hard-to-pin-down striated pillow formation. The important thing for Randy's purposes is that the individual pieces of Cap'n Crunch are, to a very rough approximation, shaped kind of like molars. The strategy, then, is to make the Cap'n Crunch chew itself by grinding the nuggets together in the center of the oral cavity, like stones in a lapidary tumbler. Like advanced ballroom dancing, verbal expressions, or for that matter, watching videotapes, only go so far, and then your body just has to learn the moves. By the time he has eaten a satisfactory amount of Cap'n Crunch, about a third of a 25-ounce box, and reached the bottom of his beer bottle, Randy has convinced himself that this whole dance thing is a practical joke. When he reaches the hotel, Amy and Doug Shafta will be waiting for him with mischievous smiles. They will tell him they were just teasing, and then take him into the bar to talk him down. Randy puts on the last few bits of his suit. Any delaying tactics are acceptable at this point, so he checks his email. 2. Randy@epiphyte.com. From root@eruditorum.org. Subject, the Pontifex Transform as requested. Randy, you are right, of course. As the Germans learned the hard way, no crypto system can be trusted until it has been published, so that people like your secret admirer friends can have a go at breaking it. I would be in your debt if you would do this with Pontifex. The transform at the heart of Pontifex has various asymmetries and special cases that make it difficult to express in a few clean, elegant lines of math. It almost has to be written down as pseudocode, but why settle for pseudo when you can have the real thing? There followed several lines of a script written in the Perl programming language. There is also one message from his palimony lawyer in California, which he prints and puts into his breast pocket to savor while he is stuck in traffic. He takes the elevator downstairs and catches a taxi to the Manila Hotel. This, riding in a taxi through Manila, would be one of the more memorable experiences of his life if this were the first time he had ever done it. But it is the millionth time, and so nothing registers. For example, he sees two cars smashed together directly beneath a giant road sign that says, "No swerving," but he doesn't really take note.
Dear Randy, the worst is over. Charlene, and more importantly, her lawyer, seem to have accepted, finally, that you are not sitting on top of a huge pile of gold in the Philippines. Now that your imaginary millions are no longer confusing the picture, we can figure out how to dispose of the assets you actually have, primarily your equity in the house. This would be much more complicated if Charlene wanted to remain there. However, it now appears that she has landed that Yale job, which means that she is just as eager to liquidate the house as you are. The question, then, will be how the proceeds of the sale should be divided between you and her. Their position appears, not surprisingly, to be that the huge increase in the house's value since you bought it is a consequence of changes in the real estate market. Never mind the $250,000 you spent shoring up the foundation, replacing the plumbing, etc., etc. I assume you kept all of the receipts, canceled checks, and other proof of how much money you spent on improvements, because that's the kind of guy you are. It would help me very much if I could pull these out and wave them around during my next round of discussions with Charlene's lawyer. Can you produce them? I realize that this will be something of an inconvenience for you. However, since you have invested most of your net worth into that house, the stakes are high.
Randy puts the page into his breast pocket and begins planning a trip to California. Most of the ballroom dancing freaks in this town belong to the social class that can afford cars and drivers. The cars are lined up all the way down the hotel's drive and out into the street, waiting to discharge their passengers, whose bright gowns are visible even through tinted windows. Attendants blow whistles and gesture with their white gloves, vectoring cars into the parking lot, where they are sintered into a tight mosaic. Some of the drivers don't even bother getting out and lean their seats back for a nap. Others gather beneath a tree at one end of the lot to smoke, joke, and shake their heads in dazed amusement at the world, in the way that only your hardened, future-shocked third-worlders can. Since he has been dreading this so much, you'd think Randy might just sit back and savor the delay. But, like jerking a bandage off a hairy part of the body, it is a deed best done quickly and suddenly. As they pull to a stop at the back of the line of limos, he shoves money at his surprised driver, opens the door, and walks the last block to the hotel. He can feel the eyes of the gowned and perfumed Filipinas playing across his husky back, like laser lights on commandos' rifles. Aging Filipinas in prom dresses have come and gone across the lobby of the Manila Hotel for as long as Randy has known the place. He hardly noticed them during the early months when he was actually living there. The first time they appeared, he assumed that some function was underway in the grand ballroom. Perhaps a wedding. Perhaps a class-action suit being filed by aging beauty contest contestants against the synthetic fibers industry. That was about as far as he got before he stopped burning out his mental circuits trying to figure everything out. Pursuing an explanation for every strange thing you see in the Philippines is like trying to get every last bit of rainwater out of a discarded tire. The Shaftos are not waiting by the door to tell him it was all a joke. So Randy squares his shoulders and stomps doggedly across the vast lobby, all alone, like a Confederate infantryman in Pickett's charge, the last man of his regiment. A photographer in a Ronald Reagan pompadour and a white tuxedo is planted before the door to the grand ballroom, shooting pictures of people on the way in, hoping that they will pay for copies on the way out. Randy shoots him such a fell look that the man's shutter finger cringes back from the button. Then it's through the big doors and into the ballroom, where, beneath swirling colored lights, hundreds of Filipinas are dancing, mostly with much younger men, to the strains of a reprocessed carpenter's tune generated by a small orchestra in the corner. Randy shells out some pesos for a corsage of sampaguita flowers. Holding it at arm's length so that he will not be plunged into a diabetic coma by its fumes, he commences a Magellanian circumnavigation of the dance floor, which is surrounded by an atoll of round tables that are adorned with white linen tablecloths, candles, and glass ashtrays. A man with a thin mustache sits alone at one of those tables, back against the wall, a cell phone against his head, one side of his face illuminated fluoroscopically by the eerie green light of its keypad. A cigarette juts from his fist. Grandma Waterhouse insisted that 7-year-old Randy take ballroom dance lessons, because one day it would come in handy. He begged to differ. Her Australian accent had turned lofty and English in the decades since she had come to America, or maybe that was his imagination. She sat there bolt upright as always on her floral chintz Gomer Ballstrud settee, the sere hills of the Palouse visible through lace curtains behind her, sipping tea from a white china cup decorated with, was it lavender roses? When she tilted the cup back, 7-year-old Randy must have been able to read the name of the china pattern off the bottom. The information must be stored in his subconscious memory somewhere. Perhaps a hypnotist could extract it. But 7-year-old Randy had other things on his mind, protesting in the strongest possible terms the assertion that ballroom dance skills could ever be of any use. At the same time, he was being patterned. Implausible, even ludicrous ideas were suffusing his brain, invisible and odorless, as carbon monoxide gas. That the Palouse was a normal landscape, that the sky was this blue everywhere, that a house should look this way, with lace curtains, leaded glass windows, and room after room full of Gomer Ballstrud furniture.
"I met your grandfather Lawrence at a dance in Brisbane," Grandma announced.
She was trying to tell him that he, Randall Lawrence Waterhouse, would not even exist had it not been for the practice of ballroom dancing. But Randy did not even know where babies came from yet, and probably wouldn't have understood even if he did. Randy straightened up, remembering his posture, and asked her a question. Did this encounter in Brisbane happen when she was 7 years old, or perhaps a little later? Perhaps if she had lived in a mobile home, the grown-up Randy would have sunk his money into a mutual fund instead of paying $10,000 to a soi-disant artisan from San Francisco to install leaded glass windows around his front door, like at Grandma's house. He provides tremendous long-lasting amusement to the Shaftos by walking right past their table without recognizing them. He looks right at Doug Shafto's date, a striking Filipina, probably in her 40s, who was in the middle of making some forceful point. Without taking her eyes off Doug and Amy Shafto, she reaches out with one long, graceful arm and snags Randy's wrist as he goes by, yanking him back like a dog on a meat leash. She then holds him there while she finishes her sentence, then looks up at him with a brilliant smile. Randy smiles back dutifully, but he does not give her the full attention she seems accustomed to, because he is a bit preoccupied by the spectacle of America Shafto in a dress. Fortunately, Amy has not gone in for the prom queen look. She is wearing a form-fitting black number with long sleeves that hide her tattoos and black tights as opposed to stockings. Randy gives her the flowers like a quarterback handing off the pigskin to a runner. She accepts them with a crooked expression like a wounded soldier biting down on a bullet. Irony aside, she has a gleam in her eye that he has never seen before. Or maybe that is just light from the mirrored ball, reflecting off cigarette smoke-induced tears. He senses in his gut that he did the right thing by showing up. As with all gut feelings, only time will tell whether this is pathetic self-delusion. He was kind of afraid that she would go through some Hollywood-esque transfiguration into a radiant goddess, which would have the same effect on Randy as an axe to the base of the skull. The fact of the matter is that she looks quite good, but arguably just as out of place as Randy is in his suit. He is hoping that they can get the dancing over right away so that he can flee the building in Cinderellan obloquy, but they bid him sit down. The orchestra takes a break, and the dancers return to their tables. Doug Shafto is comfortably sprawled back in his chair with the masculine confidence of a man who has not only killed people, but who is, furthermore, escorting the most beautiful woman in the room. Her name is Aurora Taal, and she casts her flawlessly Lancome gaze over the other Filipinas with the controlled amusement of one who has lived in Boston, Washington, and London and seen it all and come back to live in Manila anyway.
So, did you learn anything more about this Rudolph von Heckelhaber character?
Doug asks, after a few minutes of small talk. It follows that Aurora must be in on the whole secret. Doug mentioned, weeks ago, that a small number of Filipinos knew about what they were doing and that they could be trusted. He was a mathematician. He was from a wealthy Leipzig family. He was at Princeton before the war. His years there did, in fact, overlap with my grandfather's.
What kind of math did he do, Randy?
Before the war, he did number theory, which tells us nothing about what he did during the war. It wouldn't be surprising if he'd ended up working in the Third Reich's crypto apparatus.
Which wouldn't explain how he ended up here.
Randy shrugs. Maybe he did engineering work on the new generation of submarines. I don't know.
So the Reich got him involved in some kind of classified work which killed him eventually.
Doug says.
We could have guessed that for ourselves, I suppose.
Why did you mention crypto, then?
Amy asks. She has some kind of emotional metal detector that screams whenever it comes near buried assumptions and hastily stifled impulses.
I guess I have crypto on the brain, and if there was some kind of connection between von Heckelhaber and my grandfather...
Was your grandfather a crypto guy, Randy?
Doug asks.
Well, he never said anything about what he did during the war.
Classic.
But he had this trunk up in the attic, a war souvenir. It actually reminds me of a trunk full of Nipponese crypto materials that I recently saw in a cave in Kinakuta.
Doug and Amy stare at him.
It doesn't amount to anything, probably.
Randy concedes. The orchestra starts in with a Sinatra tune. Doug and Aurora smile at each other and rise to their feet. Amy rolls her eyes and looks the other way, but it's put-up-or-shut-up time now, and Randy cannot conceive of any way out. He stands up and extends his hand to the one he fears and hopes for, and she, without looking, reaches out and puts her hand into his. Randy shuffles, which is no way to dance beautifully, but does rule out snapping his partner's metatarsals. Amy is essentially no better at this than he is, but she has a better attitude. By the time they get to the end of the first dance, Randy has at least reached the point where his face is no longer burning and has gone for some 30 seconds without having to apologize for anything, and 60 without asking his partner whether she will be needing medical attention. Then the song is over, and circumstances dictate that he has to dance with Aurora Tal. This is less intimidating. Even though she is glamorous and a really good dancer, their relationship is not one that allows for the possibility of grotesque pre-erotic fumblings. Also, Aurora smiles a lot, and she has a really spectacular smile, where Amy's face was intense and preoccupied. The next dance is announced as Lady's Choice, and Randy is still trying to make eye contact with Amy when he finds this tiny middle-aged Filipina standing there asking Aurora if she would mind terribly. Aurora consigns him to the other lady like a pork belly futures contract on the commodity exchange, and suddenly Randy and the lady are dancing the Texas two-step to the strains of a pre-disco Bee Gees tune.
"So, have you found wealth in the Philippines yet?"
asks the lady, whose name Randy did not quite catch. She acts as if she expects him to know her.
My partners and I are exploring business opportunities," Randy says. "Maybe wealth will follow."
"I understand you are good with numbers," the lady says.
Randy is really racking his brain now. How does this woman know he's a numbers kind of guy?
"I'm good with math," he finally says.
"Isn't that what I said?"
"Nah, mathematicians stay away from actual specific numbers as much as possible. We like to talk about numbers without actually exposing ourselves to them. That's what computers are for."
The lady will not be denied. She has a script, and she's sticking to it.
"I have a math problem for you," the lady says.
"Shoot."
"What is the value of the following information? 15 degrees, 17 minutes, 41.32 seconds north, and 121 degrees, 57 minutes, 0.55 seconds east."
I don't know. It sounds like a latitude and longitude. Northern Luzon, right?"
The lady nods.
"You want me to tell you the value of those numbers?"
"Yes."
"Depends on what's there, I guess."
"I suppose it does,"
the lady says. And that's all she says for the rest of the dance. Other than complimenting Randy on his balletic skills, which is just as hard to interpret. Girl. Flats are harder and harder to find in Brisbane, which has become a spy boomtown, Bletchley Park down under. Their central bureau, which is set up out at the Ascot Racetrack, and another entity in a different part of town called Allied Intelligence Bureau. The people who work at Central Bureau tend to be pallid mathematics experts. The AIB people, on the other hand, remind Waterhouse very much of those Detachment 2702 fellows, tense, tanned, and taciturn. Half a mile from the Ascot Racetrack, he sees one of the latter tripping lightly down the steps of a nice gingerbready rooming house, carrying a 500-pound duffel bag on his back. The man is dressed for a long trip. A grandmotherish lady in an apron is on the veranda, waving a tea towel at him. It is like a scene from a movie. You wouldn't even know that only a few hours' flight from here, men are turning black like photographic paper in a developer tray, as their living flesh is converted into putrid gas by Clostridium bacteria. Waterhouse does not stop to estimate the probability that he, who needs a place to live, should happen along at the exact moment that a room has become available. Crypt analysts wait for lucky breaks, then exploit them. After the departing soldier has disappeared round the corner, he knocks on the door and introduces himself to the lady. Mrs. McTeague says, to the extent Waterhouse can penetrate her accent, that she likes his looks. She sounds distinctly astonished. It seems clear that the improbability of Waterhouse's having happened upon this vacant room is nothing compared to the improbability of having his looks liked by Mrs. McTeague. Thus, Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse joins a small, elite group of young men, four in all, whose looks Mrs. McTeague likes. They sleep two to a room in the bedrooms where Mrs. McTeague's offspring grew from the brightest and most beautiful children ever born into the finest adults who walk the earth, except for the King of England, the General, and Lord Mountbatten. Waterhouse's new roommate is out of town just now, but by glancing over his personal effects, Waterhouse estimates that he is paddling a black kayak from Australia to Yokosuka Naval Base, where he will slip on board a battleship and silently kill his entire crew with his bare hands before doing an Olympic qualifying dive into the bay, punching out a few sharks, climbing back into his kayak, and paddling back to Australia for a beer. The next morning, at breakfast, he meets the fellows in the next room. A red-headed British naval officer who shows all the earmarks of working at Central Bureau, and a fellow named Hale, whose nationality cannot be pegged because he's not in uniform and he's too hungover to speak. Having accomplished his mission, according to his understanding with the General's minions, found a place to live and settled his other personal affairs, Waterhouse begins hanging around the Ascot racetrack and the adjacent whorehouse, trying to find some way to make himself useful. Actually, he would rather sit in his room all day and work on his new project, which is to design a high-speed Turing machine. But he has a duty to contribute to the war effort. Even if he didn't, he suspects that when his new roommate gets back from his mission and finds him sitting indoors all day drawing circuit diagrams, he will thrash Waterhouse to the point where Mrs. McTeague will no longer like his looks. To put it mildly, Central Bureau is not the kind of place where a stranger can just wander in, check the place out, introduce himself, and find a job. Even the wandering in part is potentially fatal. Fortunately, Waterhouse has ultra-mega clearance, the highest clearance in the entire world. Unfortunately, this category of secrecy is itself so secret that its very existence is secret, and so he can't actually reveal it to anyone, unless he finds someone else with ultra-mega clearance. There are only a dozen people with ultra-mega clearance in all of Brisbane. 8 of them comprise the top of the General's command hierarchy, 3 work at Central Bureau, and 1 is Waterhouse. Waterhouse sniffs out the nerve center in the old whorehouse. Superannuated Australian territorial guards in jaunty asymmetrical hats ring the place, clutching blunderbusses. Unlike Mrs. McTeague, they don't like his looks. On the other hand, they are used to this kind of thing. Smart boys from far away showing up at the gate with long and, in the end, boring stories about how the military screwed up their orders, put them in the wrong boat, sent them to the wrong place, gave them tropical diseases, threw their belongings overboard, left them to fend for themselves. They don't shoot him, but they don't let him in. He hangs around and makes a nuisance of himself for a couple of days until he finally recognizes, and is recognized by, Abraham Sinkov. Sinkov is a top American cryptanalyst. He helped Shearn break Indigo. He and Waterhouse have crossed paths a few times, and though they aren't friends per se, their minds work the same way. This makes them brothers in a weird family that has only a few hundred members scattered about the world. In a way, it is a clearance that is rarer, harder to come by, and more mysterious than ultra-mega. Sinkov writes him a new set of papers, giving him a clearance that is very high, but not so high that he can't reveal it. Waterhouse gets a tour. Shirtless men sit in Quonset huts, made stifling by the red-hot tubes of their radios. They pluck the Nipponese Army's messages out of the air and hand them off to legions of young Australian women who punch the intercepted messages onto ETC cards. There is a cadre of American officers composed entirely of a whole department of the Electrical Till Corporation. One day, early in 1942, they put their white shirts and blue suits into mothballs, donned Army uniforms, and climbed on ships to Brisbane. Their ringleader is a guy named Lieutenant Colonel Comstock, and he has gotten the whole code-breaking process totally automated. The cards, punched by the Aussie girls, come into the machine room, stacked into ingots, which are fed through the machines. Decrypts fly out of a line printer on the other end and are taken off to another hut, where American Nisei and some white men trained in Nipponese translate them. A Waterhouse is the last thing these guys need. He's beginning to understand what the Major said to him the other day. They have passed over the watershed line. The codes are broken. Which reminds him of Turing. Ever since Alan got back from New York, he's been distancing himself from Bletchley Park. He has moved up to another installation, a radio center called Hanslop, in North Buckinghamshire, a place of reinforced concrete, wires, antennas, more military formal in its atmosphere. At the time, Waterhouse could not understand why Alan would want to move away from Bletchley. But now he knows how Alan must have felt after they turned decryption into a mechanical process, industrializing Bletchley Park. He must have felt that the battle was won, and with it, the war. The rest might seem like glorious conquest to people like the General, but to Turing, and now to Waterhouse, it just looks like tedious mopping up. It is exciting to discover electrons and figure out the equations that govern their movement. It is boring to use those principles to design electric can openers. From here on out, it's all can openers. Sinkov provides Waterhouse with a desk in the whorehouse and begins to feed him the messages that Central Bureau hasn't been able to decrypt. There are still dozens of minor Nipponese codes that remain to be broken. Maybe by breaking one or two and teaching the ETC machines to read them, Waterhouse can shorten the war by a single day or save a single life. This is a noble calling that he undertakes willingly. But, in essence, it is no different from being an army butcher who saves lives by keeping his knives clean, or a lifeboat inspector in the Navy. Waterhouse cracks those minor NIP codes one after the other. One month, he even flies up to New Guinea, where Navy divers are salvaging codebooks from a sunken NIP submarine. He lives in the jungle for 2 weeks and tries not to die, comes back to Brisbane and puts those recovered codebooks to good but dull use. Then one day the dullness of his work becomes irrelevant. On that day, he returns to Mrs. McTeague's boarding house in the evening, goes to his room, and finds a large man snoring in the upper bunk. A lot of clothing and equipment is scattered about the place, emanating sulfurous reek. The man sleeps for 2 days and then comes down late for breakfast one morning, peering around the room with adabrine yellow eyes. He introduces himself as Smith. His oddly familiar accent is not made any easier to understand by the fact that his teeth are chattering violently. He doesn't seem especially bothered by this. He sits down and paws an Irish linen napkin into his lap with a hand that is stiff and raw. Mrs. McTeague fusses over him to the extent that all of the men at the table must resist the impulse to slug her. She pours him tea with plenty of milk and sugar. He takes a few sips, then excuses himself and goes to the WC, where he crisply and politely vomits. He comes back, eats a soft-boiled egg from a bone china egg cup, turns green, leans back in his chair, and closes his eyes for about 10 minutes. When Waterhouse returns from work that evening, he blunders into the parlor and interrupts Mrs. McTeague having tea with a young lady. The young lady's name is Mary Smith. She is the cousin of Waterhouse's roommate, who is upstairs, shivering and sweating in his bunk bed. Mary stands up to be introduced, which is not technically necessary, but she is a girl from the outback and has no use for effete refinement. She is a petite girl dressed in a uniform. She is the only woman Waterhouse has ever seen. She is the only other human being in the universe, actually. And when she stands up to shake his hand, his peripheral vision shuts down as if he has been sucking on a tailpipe. Black curtains converge across a silver cyclorama, shuttering down his cosmos to a vertical shaft of carbon arc glory, a pillar of light, a heavenly follow spot targeted upon her. Mrs. McTeague, knowing the score, bids him sit down. Mary is a tiny, white-skinned, red-headed person who is often seized by little fits of self-consciousness. When this happens, she averts her eyes from his and swallows, and when she swallows, there is a certain cord in her white neck, rounding the concavity from shoulder to ear, that stands out for a moment. It draws attention both to her vulnerability and to the white flesh of her neck, which is not white in a pallid, sick way, but in another way that Waterhouse could never have understood until recently, namely from his little stint in New Guinea, where everything is either dead and decaying, or bright and threatening, or unobtrusive and invisible. Waterhouse knows that anything this tender and translucent is too vulnerable and tempting to hold its own in a world of violently competing destroyers, that it can only be sustained for a moment, let alone years, by the life force within. In the South Pacific, where the forces of death are so powerful, it leaves him vaguely intimidated. Her skin, as unmarked as clear water, is an extravagant display of vibrant animal power. He wants his tongue on it. The whole curve of her neck, from collarbone to earlobe, would make a perfect cradle for his face. She sees him looking at her and swallows again. The cord flexes, stretching the living skin of her neck out for just a moment, and then relaxes, leaving nothing but smoothness and calm. She may just as well have caved his head in with a stone and tied his penis round a hitching rail. The effect must be calculated. But apparently she has not ever done it to anyone else, or there would be a band of gold round her pale left ring finger. Mary Smith is beginning to get annoyed with him. She lifts the teacup to her lips. She has turned so that the light is grazing her neck in a new way, and this time when she swallows, he can see her Adam's apple moving up. Then it comes down like a pile driver on what is left of his good judgment. There is a thumping noise upstairs. Her cousin has just regained consciousness.
"Excuse me," she says,
and she's gone, leaving only Mrs. McTeague's bone china as a reminder. Conspiracy. Dr. Rudolf von Heckelhaber is not much older than Sergeant Bobby Shafto, but even emotionally crushed, he has a certain bearing about him that men in Shafto's world don't acquire until they are in their 40s. If then. His eyeglasses have tiny rimless lenses that look like they were scavenged from a sniper's telescopic sights. Behind them is a whole paint box of vivid colors. Blonde lashes, blue eyes, red veins, lids swollen and purple from weeping. Even so, he has a perfect shave, and the silvery Nordic light coming in through the tiny windows of Enoch Root's church cellar glances from the planes of his face so as to highlight an interesting terrain of big pores, premature creases, and old dueling scars. He has tried to grease his hair back, but it misbehaves and keeps tumbling down over his brow. He is wearing a white dress shirt and a very long, heavy overcoat on top of that to ward off the cellar's chill. Shafto, who hiked back to Norsbrook with him several days ago, knows that the long-legged von Heckelhaber has the makings of a half-decent jock. But he can tell that rude sports like football would be out of the question. This kraut would be a fencer or a mountain climber or a skier. Shafto was only startled, not bothered, by von Heckelhaber's homosexuality. Some of the China Marines in Shanghai had a lot more young Chinese boys hanging around their flats than they really needed to shine their boots. And Shanghai is far from the strangest and most far-flung place where Marines made themselves at home between the wars. You can worry about morality when you're off duty, but if you are always stewing and fretting over what the other guys are doing in the sack, then what the hell are you going to do when you're presented with an opportunity to hit a nip squad with a flamethrower? They buried the remains of Angelo, the pilot, 2 weeks ago, and only now is von Heckelhaber feeling in any kind of shape to talk. He has rented a cottage outside of town, but he has come into Norsbrook to meet with Root, Shafto, and Bischoff on this day, partly because he is convinced that German spies are watching it. Shafto shows up with a bottle of Finnish schnapps. Bischoff brings a loaf of bread. Root breaks out a tin of fish. Von Heckelhaber brings information. Everyone brings cigarettes. Shafto smokes early and often, trying to kill the mildewy smell of the cellar, which reminds him of being locked up there with Enoch Root, kicking his morphine habit. During that time, the pastor once had to come downstairs and ask him to please stop screaming for a while, because they were trying to do a wedding upstairs. Shafto hadn't known he was screaming. Rudolf von Heckelhaber's English is, in some respects, better than Shafto's. He sounds unnervingly like Bobby's junior high school drafting teacher, Mr. Jaeger.
"Before the war, I worked under Dönitz for the Beobachtungsdienst of the Kriegsmarine. We broke some of the most secret codes of the British Admiralty even before the outbreak of hostilities. I was responsible for some advances in this field, involving the use of mechanical calculation, When war broke out, there was much reorganization, and I became like a bone that several dogs are fighting over. I was moved into Referat Iva of Group Fünf, Analytical Cryptanalysis, which was part of Hauptgruppe B, Cryptanalysis, which reported ultimately to Major General Erich Feldgiebel, Chief of Wehrmacht Nachrichtungen Verbindungen.
Shafto looks around at the others, but none of them laughs or even grins. They must not have heard it.
"Come again?"
Shafto asks, proddingly, like a man in a bar trying to get a shy friend to tell a surefire thigh-slapper.
"Wehrmacht Nachrichtungen Verbindungen,"
von Heckelhaber says, very slowly, as if repeating nursery rhymes to a toddler. He blinks once, twice, three times at Shafto, then sits forward and says brightly,
"Perhaps I should explain the organization of the German intelligence hierarchy, since it will help you all to understand my story."
A brief trip into Hell's Demo with Herr Doctor Professor Rudolf von Heckelhaber ensues.
Shafto only hears the first couple of sentences. At about the point when von Heckelhaber tears a sheet out of a notebook and begins to diagram the organizational tree of the Thousand-Year Reich with Der Führer at the top, Shafto's eyes take on a heavy glaze, his body goes slack, he becomes deaf, and he accelerates up the throat of a nightmare, like the butt of a half-digested corn dog being reverse-peristalsed from the body of an addict. He has never been through this experience before, but he knows intuitively that this is how the trip to hell works. No leisurely boat ride across the scenic Styx, no gradual descent into that trite tourist trap Pluto's Cavern, no stops along the way to buy fishing licenses for the Lake of Fire. Shafto is not, though he should be, dead. And so this is not hell. It is closely modeled after hell, though. It is like a mock-up slapped together from tar paper and canvas, like the fake towns where they practiced house-to-house warfare during boot camp. Shafto is gripped with a sort of giddy queasiness that he knows is the most pleasant thing he will feel here.
"Morphine takes away the body's ability to experience pleasure," says the booming voice of Enoch Root, his wry, annoying Virgil, who for purposes of this nightmare has adopted the voice and physical shape of Mo, the mean, dark-haired stooge.
"It may be some time before you feel physically well."
The organizational tree of this nightmare begins, like von Heckelhaber's, with Der Führer, but then branches out widely and crazily. There is an Asian branch, headed up by the general and including, among other things, a Hauptgruppe of giant carnivorous lizards, a referat of Chinese women holding up pale-eyed babies, and several Abteilungs of plastered nips with swords. In the center of their domain is the city of Manila, where, in a tableau that Shafto would identify as Boshin if he had not spent his high school art class out behind the school leg-fucking cheerleaders, a heavily pregnant Gloria Altamir is being forced to do blowjobs on syphilitic Nipponese troops. The voice of Mr. Jaeger, his drafting teacher, the most boring man Shafto had ever known until perhaps today, fades in for a moment with the words, "But all of the organizational structures I have detailed to this point became obsolete at the outbreak of hostilities. The hierarchy was shuffled and several of the entities changed their names as follows." Shafto hears a new sheet of paper being torn from the notebook, but what he sees is Mr. Jaeger tearing up a diagram of a table leg bracket that the young Bobby Shafto has spent a week drafting. Everything has been reorganized. General MacArthur is still very high in the tree, walking a brace of giant lizards on steel leashes, but now the hierarchy is filled with grinning Arabs holding up lumps of hashish, frozen butchers, dead or doomed lieutenants, and that fucking weirdo Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse, dressed in a black hooded robe, heading up a whole legion of pencil-necked signals geeks, also in robes, holding bizarrely shaped antennas above their heads, wading through a blizzard of dollar bills printed on old Chinese newspapers. Their eyes glow, flashing on and off in Morse code.
"What are they saying?"
Bobby says.
"Please stop screaming," says Enoch Root. "Just for a little while."
Bobby's lying on a cot in a thatched hut in Guadalcanal. Swedish tribesmen run around in loincloths, gathering food. Every so often a ship gets blown up out in the slot, and fish shrapnel rains down and gets hung up in the branches. along with the occasional severed human arm or hunk of skull. The Swedes ignore the human bits and harvest the fish, taking it off to make lutefisk in black steel drums. Enoch Root has an old cigar box on his lap. Golden light is shining out of the crack around its lid. But he's not in the thatched hut anymore. He's inside a cold, black metal phallus that has been probing around down below the surface of the nightmare. Bischoff's submarine. Depth charges are going off all over the place, and it's filling up with sewage. Something clocks him on the side of the head. Not a ham this time, but a human leg. The sub's lined with tubes that carry voices in English, German, Arabic, Nipponese, Shanghainese, but confined and muffled in the plumbing so that they mingle together like they're running of water. Then a pipe is ruptured by a near miss from a depth charge. From its jagged end issues a German voice. "So foregoing may be taken as a rather coarse-grained treatment of the general organization of the Reich, and particularly the military. Responsibility for cryptanalysis and cryptography is distributed among a large number of small amts and diensts attached to various tendrils of the structure. These are continually being reorganized and rearranged. However, I may be able to provide you with a reasonably accurate and detailed picture." Shafto, chained to a bunk in the submarine by fetters of gold, feels one of his small concealed handguns pressing into the small of his back, and wonders whether it would be bad form to shoot himself in the mouth. He paws wildly at the broken tube and manages to slap it down into the rising sewage. Bubbles come out, and von Heckelhaber's words are trapped in them, like word balloons in a comic strip. When the bubbles reach the surface and burst, it sounds like screaming. Root is sitting on the opposite bunk with the cigar box on his lap. He holds up his hand in a V for victory, then levels it at Shafto's face and pokes him in the eye.
"I cannot help you with your inability to find physical comfort. It is a problem of body chemistry," he says. "It poses interesting theological questions. It reminds us that all the pleasures of the world are an illusion projected into our souls by our bodies."
A lot of the other speaking tubes have ruptured now, and screaming comes from most of them. Root has to lean close in order to shout into Bobby's ear. Shafto takes advantage of it to reach over and make a grab for the cigar box, which contains the stuff he wants. Not morphine. Something better than morphine. Morphine is to the stuff in the cigar box what a Shanghai prostitute is to glory. The box flies open, and blinding light comes out of it. Shafto covers his face. The salted and preserved body parts suspended from the ceiling tumble into his lap and begin to writhe, reaching out for other parts, assembling themselves into living bodies. Mikulski comes back to life, aims his Vickers at the ceiling of the U-boat, and cuts an escape hatch. Instead of black water, golden light rushes through.
"What was your position in all this, then?" asks Root.
And Shafto nearly jumps out of his chair, startled by the sound of a voice other than von Heckelhaber's. "Given what happened the last time someone," Shafto, "asked a question, this is heroic but risky. Starting with Hitler, von Heckelhaber works his way down the chain of command." Shafto doesn't care. He's on a rubber raft, along with various resurrected comrades from Guadalcanal and Detachment 2702. They are rowing across a still cove lit by giant flaming Klieg lights in the sky. Standing behind the Klieg lights is a man talking in a German accent. "My immediate supervisors, Wilhelm Fenner from St. Petersburg, who headed all German military cryptanalysis from 1922 onwards, and his chief deputy, Professor Novopesheny." All of these names sound alike to Shafto, but Root says, "A Russian?" Shafto is really coming around now, re-emerging into the world. He sits up straight, and his body feels stiff, like it hasn't moved in a long time. He is about to apologize for the way he has been behaving, but since no one is looking at him funny, Shafto sees no reason to fill them in on what he's been doing these last few minutes. "Professor Novopesheny was a Tsarist astronomer who knew Fenner from St. Petersburg. Under them, I was given broad authority to pursue researches into the theoretical limits of security. I used tools from pure mathematics as well as mechanical calculating devices of my own design. I looked at our own codes as well as those of our enemies, looking for weaknesses."
What did you find? Bischoff asks. I found weaknesses everywhere, von Hackelhaber says. Most codes were designed by dilettantes and amateurs with no grasp of the underlying mathematics. It is really quite pitiable. Including the Enigma? Bischoff asks. Don't even talk to me of that shit, von Hackelhaber says. I dispensed with it almost immediately. What do you mean, dispensed with it? Root asks. Proved that it was shit, von Hackelhaber says. But the entire Wehrmacht still uses it, Bischoff says. Von Hackelhaber shrugs and looks at the burning tip of his cigarette. You expect them to throw all those machines away because one mathematician writes a paper. He stares at his cigarette a while longer, then puts it to his lips, draws on it tastefully, holds the smoke in his lungs, and finally exhales it slowly through his vocal cords, whilst simultaneously causing them to emit the following sounds. I knew that there must be people working for the enemy who would figure this out. Turing, von Neumann, Waterhouse, some of the Poles. I began to look for signs that they had broken the Enigma, or at least realized its weaknesses, and begun trying to break it. I ran statistical analyses of convoy sinkings and U-boat attacks. I found some anomalies, some improbable events, but not enough to make a pattern. Many of the grossest anomalies were later accounted for by the discovery of espionage stations and the like. From this I drew no conclusion. Certainly, if they were smart enough to break the Enigma, they would be smart enough to conceal the fact from us at any cost. But there was one anomaly they could not cover up. I refer to human anomalies. Human anomalies? Root asks. The phrase is classic Root bait. I knew perfectly well that only a handful of people in the world had the acumen to break the Enigma and then to cover up the fact that they had broken it. By using our intelligence sources to ascertain where these men were and what they were doing, I could make inferences. Von Hackelhaber stubs out his cigarette, sits up straight, and drains a half-shot of schnapps, warming to the task. This was a human intelligence problem, not signals intelligence. This is handled by a different branch of the service. And he's off again talking about the structure of the German bureaucracy. Terrified, Shafto flees from the room, runs outside and uses the outhouse. When he gets back, von Hackelhaber is just winding up. It all came down to a problem of sifting through large amounts of raw data, lengthy and tedious work. Shafto cringes, wondering what something would have to be like in order to qualify as lengthy and tedious to this joker. After some time, von Hackelhaber continues, I learned, through some of our agents in the British Isles, that a man matching the general description of Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse had been stationed to a castle in Outer Tagum. I was able to arrange for a young lady to place this man under the closest possible surveillance, he says dryly. His security precautions were impeccable, and so he learnt nothing directly. In fact, it is quite likely that he knew that the young woman in question was an agent, and so he took added precautions. But we did learn that this man communicated through one-time pads. He would read his encrypted messages over the telephone to a nearby naval base, whence they would be telegraphed to a station in Buckinghamshire, which would respond to him with messages encrypted using the same system of one-time pads. By going through the records of our various radio intercept stations, we were able to accumulate a stack of messages that had been sent by this mysterious unit, using this series of one-time pads, over a period of time beginning in the middle of 1942 and continuing up to the present day. It was interesting to note that this unit operated in a variety of places, Malta, Alexandria, Morocco, Norway, and various ships at sea. Extremely unusual. I was very interested in this mysterious unit, and so I began trying to break their special code. Isn't that impossible? Bischoff asks. There is no way to break a one-time pad short of stealing a copy. That is true in theory, von Hackelhaber says. In practice, this is only true if the letters that make up the one-time pad are chosen perfectly randomly. But, as I discovered, this is not true of the one-time pads used by Detachment 2702, which is the mysterious unit that Waterhouse, Turing, and these two gentlemen all belong to.
But how did you figure this out? Bischoff asks.
A few things helped me. There was a lot of depth, many messages to work with. There was consistency. The one-time pads were generated in the same way, always, and always exhibited the same patterns. I made some educated guesses which turned out to be correct. And I had a calculating machine to make the work go faster.
Educated guesses?
I had a hypothesis that the one-time pads were being drawn up by a person who was rolling dice or shuffling a deck of cards to produce the letters. I began to consider psychological factors. An English speaker is accustomed to a certain frequency distribution of letters. He expects to see a great many E's, T's, and A's, and not so many Z's and Q's and X's. So if such a person were using some supposedly random algorithm to generate the letters, he would be subconsciously irritated every time a Z or an X came up, and, conversely, soothed by the appearance of E or T. Over time, this might skew the frequency distribution.
But Herr Dr. von Hackelheber, I find it unlikely that such a person would substitute their own letters for the ones that came up on the cards or dice or whatever.
It is not very likely. But suppose that the algorithm gave the person some small amount of discretion.
Von Hackelheber lights another cigarette, pours out more schnapps.
I set up an experiment. I got 20 volunteers, middle-aged women who wanted to do their part for the Reich. I set them to work drawing up one-time pads using an algorithm where they drew slips out of a box. Then I used my machinery to run statistical calculations on the results. I found that they were not random at all.
Root says, the one-time pads for Detachment 2702 are being created by Mrs. Tenney, a vicar's wife. She uses a bingo machine, a cage filled with wooden balls with a letter stamped on each ball. She is supposed to close her eyes before reaching into the cage, but supposes she has become sloppy and no longer closes her eyes when she reaches into it.
Or, von Hackelheber says, suppose she looks at the cage and sees how the balls are distributed inside of it and then closes her eyes. She will subconsciously reach toward the E and avoid the Z. Or if a certain letter has just come up recently, she will try to avoid choosing it again. Even if she cannot see the inside of the cage, she will learn to distinguish among the different balls by their feel. Being made of wood, each ball will have a different weight, a different pattern in the grain.
Bischoff's not buying it.
But it will still be mostly random.
Mostly random is not good enough,
von Hackelheber snaps.
I was convinced that the one-time pads of Detachment 2702 would have a frequency distribution similar to that of the King James Version of the Bible, for example, and I strongly suspected that the content of those messages would include words such as Waterhouse, Turing, Enigma, Tagum, Malta. By putting my machinery to work, I was able to break some of the one-time pads. Waterhouse was careful to burn his pads after using them once, but some other parts of the detachment were careless and used the same pads again and again. I read many messages. It was obvious that Detachment 2702 was in the business of deceiving the Wehrmacht by concealing the fact that the Enigma had been broken.
Shafto knows what an Enigma is, if only because Bischoff won't shut up about them. When von Hackelheber explains this, everything that Detachment 2702 ever did suddenly makes sense.
So, the secret is out, then, Root says.
I assume you made your superiors aware of your discovery?
I made them aware of absolutely nothing,
von Hackelheber snarls.
Because by this time I had long since fallen into a snare of Reichsmarschall Hermann Göring. I had become his pawn, his slave, and had ceased to feel any loyalty whatsoever towards the Reich.
The knock on Rudolf von Hackelheber's door had come at 4 o'clock in the morning, a time exploited by the Gestapo for its psychological effect. Rudy is wide awake. Even if bombers had not been pounding Berlin all night long, he would have been awake, because he has neither seen nor heard from Angelo in 3 days. He throws a dressing gown over his pajamas, steps into slippers, and opens the door of his flat to reveal, predictably, a small, prematurely withered man backed up by a couple of classic Gestapo killers in long black leather coats.
"May I proffer an observation?" says Rudy von Heckelhaber.
"But of course, Herr Doctor Professor. As long as it is not a state secret, of course."
"In the old days, the early days, when no one knew what the Gestapo was, and no one was afraid of it, this four-in-the-morning business was clever, a fine way to exploit man's primal fear of the darkness. But now it is 1942, almost 1943, and everyone is afraid of the Gestapo. Everyone. More than they are of the dark. So why don't you work during the daytime? You are stuck in a rut."
The bottom half of the withered man's face laughs. The top half doesn't change.
"I will pass your suggestion up the chain of command," he says. "But, Herr Doctor, we are not here to instill fear. We have come at this inconvenient time because of the train schedules."
"Am I to understand that I am getting on a train?"
"You have a few minutes,"
the Gestapo man says, pulling back a cuff to divulge a hulking Swiss chronometer. Then he invites himself in and begins to pace up and down in front of Rudy's bookshelves, hands clasped behind back, bending at the waist to peer at the titles. He seems disappointed to find that they are all mathematical texts, not a single copy of the Declaration of Independence in evidence, though you can never tell when a copy of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion might be hidden between the pages of a mathematical journal.
When Rudy emerges, dressed but still unshaven, he finds the man displaying a pained expression while trying to read Turing's dissertation on the universal machine. He looks like a lower primate trying to fly an aeroplane.
Half an hour later, they are at the train station. Rudy looks up at the departures board as they go in and memorizes its contents, so that he will be able to deduce from the track number whether he's being taken in the direction of Leipzig or Königsberg or Warsaw. It is a clever thing to do, but it turns out to be a waste of effort, because the Gestapo men lead him to a track that is not listed on the board. A short train waits there. It does not contain any boxcars, a relief to Rudy, since he thinks that during the last few years he may have glimpsed boxcars that appear to be crammed full of human beings. These glimpses were brief and surreal, and he could not really sort out whether they really happened or were merely fragments of nightmares that got filed in the wrong cranial drawer. But all of the cars on this train have doors, guarded by men in unfamiliar uniforms, and windows shrouded on the inside with shutters and heavy curtains. The Gestapo lead him to a coach door without breaking stride, and just like that, he is through. And he is alone. No one checks his papers, and the Gestapo do not enter behind him. The door is closed behind his back. Dr. Rudolf von Heckelhaber is standing in a long, skinny car decorated like the anteroom of an upper-class whorehouse, with Persian runners on the polished hardwood floor, heavy furniture upholstered in maroon velvet, and curtains so thick that they look bulletproof. At one end of the coach, a French maid hovers over a table, set with breakfast, hard rolls, slices of meat and cheese, and coffee. Rudy's nose tells him that it is real coffee, and the smell draws him down to the end of the car. The maid pours him a cup with trembling hands. She has plastered thick foundation beneath her eyes to conceal dark circles, and he realizes as she hands him the cup, she has also painted it onto her wrists. Rudy savors the coffee, stirring cream into it with a golden spoon bearing the mark of a French family. He strolls up and down the length of the car, admiring the art on the walls, a series of Dürer engravings, and, unless his eyes deceive him, a couple of pages from a Leonardo da Vinci codex. The door opens again, and a man enters clumsily, as if thrown on board, and ends up sprawled over a velvet settee. By the time Rudy recognizes him, the train has already begun to pull out of the station.
"Angelo!"
Rudy sets his coffee down on an end table and throws himself into the arms of his beloved. Angela returns the embrace weakly. He stinks, and he shudders uncontrollably. He is wearing a coarse, dirty pajama-like garment, and is wrapped up in a gray wool blanket. His wrists are encircled by half-scabbed lacerations embedded in fields of yellow-green bruises.
"Don't worry about it, Rudy,"
Angelo says, clenching and opening his fists to prove that they still work.
They were not kind to me, but they took care with my hands.
Thou canst still fly.
I can still fly, but that is not why they were so careful with my hands.
Why then?
Without hands, a man cannot sign a confession.
Rudy and Angelo gaze into each other's eyes. Angelo looks sad, exhausted, but still has some kind of serene confidence about him. Like a baptizing priest ready to receive the infant, he holds up his hands. He silently mouths the words, "But I can still fly." A suit of clothes is brought in by a valet. Angelo cleans up in one of the coach's lavatories. Rudy tries to peer out between the curtains, but heavy shutters have been pulled down over the windows. They breakfast together as the train maneuvers through the switching yards of Greater Berlin, perhaps working its way around some bombed-out sections of track, and finally accelerates into the open territory beyond. Reichsmarschall Hermann Göring makes his way through the car, headed towards the rear of the train, where the most ornate coach is located. His body is about as big as the hull of a torpedo boat, draped in a circus tent-sized Chinese silk robe, the sash of which drags on the floor behind him like a leash trailing behind a dog. He has the largest belly of any man Rudy has ever seen, and it is covered with golden hair that deepens as the belly curves under until it becomes a tawny thicket that completely conceals his genitals. He is not really expecting to see two men sitting here eating breakfast, but seems to consider Rudy and Angelo's presence here to be one of life's small anomalies, not really worth noticing. Given that Göring is the number two man in the Third Reich, the designated successor to Hitler himself, Rudy and Angelo really should jump to attention and give him a Heil Hitler. But they are too stunned to move. Göring stumbles down the middle of the coach, paying them no mind. Halfway down, he begins talking, but he's talking to himself, and his words are slurred. He slams open the door at the end of the coach and proceeds into the next car. 2 hours later, a doctor in a white coat passes through, headed for Göring's coach, carrying a silver tray with a white linen cloth on it. Tastefully arrayed on this, like caviar and champagne, are a blue bottle and a glass hypodermic syringe. Half an hour after that, an aide in a Luftwaffe uniform passes through, carrying a sheaf of papers, and favors Rudy and Angelo with a crisp, "Heil Hitler!" Another hour goes by, and then Rudy and Angelo are escorted back through the train by a servant. The coach at the rear of the train is darker and more gentlemanly than the florid parlor where they have been cooling their heels. It is paneled in darkly stained wood and contains an actual desk, a baronial monstrosity carved out of a ton of Bavarian oak. At the moment, its sole function is to support a single sheet of paper, handwritten and signed at the bottom. Even from a distance, Rudy recognizes Angelo's handwriting. They have to walk past the desk in order to reach Göring, who is spread across an equally massive couch at the end of the car, underneath a Matisse and flanked between a couple of Roman busts on marble pedestals. He is dressed in red leather jodhpurs, red leather boots, a red leather uniform jacket, a red leather riding crop with a fat diamond set into the butt of the handle. Bracelet-sized gold rings, infected with big rubies, grip his pudgy fingers. A red leather officer's cap is perched on his head, with a gold death's head, with ruby eyes, centered above the bill. All of this is illuminated only by a few striations of dusty light that have forced their way in through tiny crevices between curtains and shutters. The sun is up now, but Göring's blue eyes, dilated to dime-sized pits by the morphine, cannot face it. He has his cherry-colored boots up on an ottoman. No doubt he has trouble with circulation in his legs. He is drinking tea from a thimble-sized porcelain cup, encrusted with gold leaf, looted from a chateau somewhere. Heavy cologne fails to mask his odor. Bad teeth, intestinal trouble, and necrotizing hemorrhoids.
"Good morning, gentlemen,"
he says brightly.
Sorry to have kept you waiting. Heil Hitler, would you like some tea?
There is small talk. It goes on at length. Goering is fascinated with Angela's work as a test pilot. Not only that, he has any number of peculiar ideas adapted from the Bavarian Illuminati, and is groping for some way to tie these in with higher mathematics. Rudy is afraid, for a while, that this task is about to be placed on his shoulders, but even Goering himself seems impatient with this phase of the conversation. Once or twice, he reaches out with his riding crop to part a curtain slightly. The outdoor light seems to cause him appalling pain, and he quickly looks away. But finally, the train slows, maneuvers through more switches, and coasts to a gentle stop. They can see nothing, of course. Rudy strains his ears and thinks he hears activity around them. Many feet marching and commands being shouted. Goering catches the eye of an aide and waves his riding crop towards the desk. The aide springs forward, snatches up the handwritten document, and bears it over to the Reichsmarschall, presenting it with a small near bow. Goering reads through it quickly. Then he looks up at Rudy and Angelo and makes tut-tut-tut noises, shaking his gigantic head from side to side. Various layers of jowls, folds, and wattles follow, always a few degrees out of phase.
Homosexuality, Goering says. You must be aware of the Führer's policy regarding this sort of behavior.
He holds up the sheet and shakes it.
Shame on you, both of you. A test pilot who is a guest in our country, and an eminent mathematician working on great secrets. You must have known that the Sicherheitsdienst would get wind of this.
He heaves an exhausted sigh.
Oh, how am I going to patch this up?
When Goering says this, Rudy knows for the first time since the knock on his door that he is not going to die today. Goering has something else in mind. But first, his victims need to be properly terrified.
Do you know what could happen to you? Do you?
Neither Rudy nor Angelo answers. It is not the sort of question that really needs answering. Goering answers it for them by reaching out with his riding crop and lifting up the curtain. Harsh blue light, reflected from snow, peels into the coach. Goering shuts his eyes and looks the other way. They are in the middle of an open area, surrounded by tall barbed wire fences, filled with long rows of dark barracks. In the center, a tall stack pours smoke into a white sky. SS troops in greatcoats and jackboots pace around, blowing into their hands. Just a few yards away from them, on an adjacent railway siding, a gang of wretches in striped clothing are at work in and around a boxcar unloading pale cargo. A large number of naked human bodies have become all frozen together in a solid, tangled mass inside the boxcar, and the prisoners are at work with axes, bucksaws, and pry bars, dismantling them and throwing the parts onto the ground. Because they are frozen solid, there is no blood, and so the entire operation is startlingly clean. The double-glazed windows of Goering's coach block sound so effectively that the impact of a big fire axe on a frozen abdomen comes through as a nearly imperceptible thud. One of the prisoners turns toward them, carrying a thigh toward a wheelbarrow, and risks a direct look at the Reichsmarschall's train. This prisoner has a pink triangle sewn to the breast of his uniform. The prisoner's eyes are trying to probe through the window, past the curtain, trying to make a human connection with someone on the inside of the coach. Rudy stiffens in panic for a moment, thinking that the prisoner sees him. Then Goering withdraws the riding crop and the curtain falls. A few moments later, the train begins to move again. Rudy looks at his lover. Angelo is sitting frozen, just like one of those corpses, with his hands over his face. Goering flips his crop dismissively.
Get out,
he says. What? Ask Rudy and Angelo simultaneously. Goering laughs heartily.
No, no, I don't mean get out of the train. I mean Angelo get out of this coach. I want to talk to Herr Dr. Professor von Hackelheber in private. You may wait in the parlor car.
Angelo leaves eagerly. Goering waves his crop at a couple of hovering aides, and they leave too. Goering and Rudy are alone together.
I am sorry to show you these unpleasant things, Goering says. I simply wanted to impress upon you the importance of keeping secrets.
I can assure the Reichsmarschall that...
Goering shushes him with a wave of the crop.
Don't be tedious. I know that you have sworn any number of great oaths and been through all of the indoctrination concerning secrecy. I have no doubt of your sincerity, but it is all just words and not good enough for the work that I wish you to begin doing for me. To work for me, you must see the thing I have shown you so that you can really understand the stakes.
Rudy looks at the floor, takes a deep breath, and forces out the words.
It would be a great honor to work for you, Reichsmarschall. But since you have access to so many of the great museums and libraries of Europe, there is only one small favor I, as a scholar, might humbly request of you.